Okay, very good. So that's Nate there. So yeah, CTR club members, yes, we'll just show up to the emergency prep net and check in normally. So let's see. And Paul, KE7OLU, there was a question of whether we have a first Monday of the month coming up next week, if you're going to use the 529 to hold a meeting again.
Kilo Echo 7, Oscar Lima Uniform, Paul. Affirmative, we will be meeting on the air on the 529 repeater at 7 p.m. this coming Monday. KE7, what are you?
KE7, KPF comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Tim.
Thanks for bringing it up, Brett. Paul and Nate, thank you for responding. KA7, give you a back to that.
Late check-in.
Go ahead, check-in.
KA7, JCD, tardy.
Me too.
This is KI7 Whiskey Julia Sierra, Dawn in West Salem. A little bit late.
Let's see, that was Kilo India 7 Whiskey Juliet Sierra. Did I get that right?
That's affirmative. You got it right.
Kilo Foxtrot 6 Foxtrot Yankee Delta Richard Salem, Oregon.
Kilo India 7 Sierra Oscar X-ray J in Salem.
Okay, there's also Richard, Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta, and Jay, Kilo India 7, Sierra Oscar X-ray. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and hand the mic over to Sheila Sund, MD, who will give us a brief overview of COVID-19 as it affects us locally here, and guys start thinking of some questions for her after that. So here's Sheila.
Hello, everybody. I thought we'd start, like most of the time, with a little bit of an update of what's happening in Oregon, because that's where most of us are from. Things continue to look quite good in Oregon. They're actually started looking for recovery and have now, they've actually been calling everybody that had a positive test, and they're able to show that about 38% of the people that survived it are now considered recovered. They had a median time from when they first got their symptoms to when they were fully recovered with no more symptoms of 15 days. That's pretty long. And if they were hospitalized, it was even longer, 19 days. However, that is skewed because in Oregon, we only tested people that were pretty sick. So if we included all the people with mild symptoms, the number of days that they had symptoms probably would be much shorter than the 15 that they're reporting. We continue to have a slow increase in our total number of cases, but the amount that we're going up does seem to have dropped down to the 50s or below most of the days. So that's a slight recovery. That's also reflected in fewer people ending up in the hospital and fewer cases with COVID-like symptoms showing up in the ER. So overall, I think it's pretty safe to say that in Oregon, our amount of cases is starting to slightly decrease. Not a lot, but it is definitely not going up, and it's probably slightly decreasing. Again, our numbers, however, don't mean a whole lot, and that's because we keep changing the guidance for what we're testing. The most recent change is good news for those of us who are over 60, who think we might venture back out into society, because the guidance now says if you're over 60 or if you have underlying health conditions and you have symptoms, you can get tested now. And that's the first time it's ever been that in Oregon, even though they've been doing that in other states for quite a while. That's really the first time that it's an official guidance in Oregon that if you're over 60 or you have underlying health conditions and you have symptoms that might be COVID, you are now fully eligible for a test. So hopefully you won't need that, but if you do, at least you can get tested. If you're under 60 and healthy and you have symptoms, tough luck. You still don't get tested unless you're involved in healthcare. The other good news in Oregon is that they have been looking, out of all the tests that they do, how many are turning up positive. And our numbers are actually incredibly low of all the tests that we're doing, and we're not doing that many, and we've been doing mostly people in the hospital. We're still only have only had 4 to 5% of the tests turn out positive, and that's actually dropped from a high of about 5.8% down to 4.3%. So even though we're only testing people with symptoms and a lot of the time people that were in the hospital, we're still only having about 4.3% of the tests come back positive. So overall, again, Oregon looks really good. We don't have very many cases compared to many states. So that means we should all be able to just drop social distancing and run back out and play all we want, right? No, unfortunately, it's not going to work quite like that. As for how many cases we have in Oregon right now, their official estimate, but they don't report how they came up with it, but their official estimate from their modeling experts is that they think we've got about 3,000 people with active disease in Oregon right now. I have no idea how they came up with that number. I personally, judging by asymptomatic cases, would guess that it's probably higher, but it still may not be more than about 10,000 total active infections in Oregon. And compared to, you know, a couple million population, that's a pretty low risk. So let's talk about relaxing social distancing. Basically, what we're going to be doing is playing what I consider R-naught or reproductive number experiments. And pretty much every state and often even counties and cities throughout the country are going to be playing a series of these R-naught experiments. R-naught is if one person is sick, how many other people are they going to infect? And when this first came out, when COVID first came out, looking at China and the early data from Europe, we were estimating that each person that got COVID infected about 2.5 other people. And that's based both upon the virus itself in terms of how infectious it is, but also how many people an infected person came in contact with in their normal life. So when you put social distancing down, that R naught drops because even if you're sick, you just don't have contact with as many people. And we don't know exactly what it is, but judging by the fact that our numbers in Oregon are slowly declining, if I had a guess, I would say our R-naught right now is a little bit less than one. When one person infects one other person, that basically means you're stable. It just stays at the same level forevermore. If you go above one, your cases increase. If you go below one, your numbers drop. And so I think we're probably a little bit less than one right now, because our numbers are starting to slowly drop. So we're down maybe 0.9 compared to maybe 2.5 when this all started before we put social distancing in place. So the question will be, as we relax social distancing, what will our R-naught change to? What we're going to try and do is add back a little bit and see if the cases go up. If they go up just a little bit and find a new steady state, then we're probably still around an R-naught of 1 to 1.1. But if we increase it too much, then the number of people infected by each new infection will start climbing up and the cases will climb. The problem is it will take a while to see that. The smaller the amount that R-naught goes up, the longer it would take. So if it went from 0.9 to 1.1, it might take us a month or two before we even have a clue that's happening. On the other hand, if we went from a R-naught of 0.9 up to an R-naught of 2, we would notice that within a couple of weeks. So that's what we're going to be playing with now as we start to relax social distancing. And with that, I'll open up for questions.
K6, Sierra Tango X-ray.
Okay, Dan, go ahead, please.
We say if we're over 60 and we can get tested, where do we go get tested? Do you just check into the hospital, or where is it they're going to have these checking points?
Testing, it varies a little bit throughout the state. First of all, getting tested, you still have to have symptoms that make your doctor think you have COVID. But if your doctor follows the guidance, they have a couple of choices. Depending upon where you're at, they could send you for a test at your hospital, and that could be done as an outpatient at the lab at the hospital, or they can swab you in the office themselves and send that off to a lab. I think most of the doctors are preferring to send you to a hospital testing site. So like Salem Health had a couple outpatient sites, one up in Woodburn and one over on River Road where they were doing their testing. And I haven't checked with them for a few weeks, but I think that's probably still where you would go. Your doctor would have to order the test from them. You'd call up and you'd schedule an appointment and you'd go in and get it done at one of their outpatient settings for Salem Health.
Okay, good question. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. You have the emergency preparedness net. Are there any other questions about COVID-19 for Dr. Sun?
KK7, ART with a question.
Yes, go ahead, Art.
Well, I guess more than a question, this is something I'd like you to comment on. I read yesterday about three prisons that had been tested and had insanely high infection rates. One of them, I want to say, had close to 1,000 inmates tested, and over 90% of them were infected with the virus. But they said only 5 inmates had any symptoms at all, and all the rest of them were asymptomatic. You know, some of these people haven't led the healthiest of lives. How, in your opinion, is that possible that there's only a few that are symptomatic and almost all of them are testing positive? I'm just curious. KK7ART.
I would need to know which prison it was, and I would, actually specifically what I would need to know is what test they used. There are a lot of tests out there that do not have great accuracies, and so and haven't always been approved by the FDA. That doesn't mean that a variety of settings, including prisons and businesses, have still been able to purchase them because we don't have any real federal regulations on that. So if they tested them using one of the many non-approved tests, that might create an absurdly high false positive rate. That's such a high rate, I have not actually seen any of the more detailed reports that have suggested something that high. I've seen places where maybe you're getting up to 50% of people infected and maybe two-thirds to three-quarters of those are asymptomatic. So if you have the name of the prison, I'd be glad to research it more and see if I could find out what the testing was. But at least so far, that doesn't match with the numbers that I've been seeing.
Thank you. I'll try to look up the name of the prison. I have no idea what variety of tests they used. That wasn't in the article, but I will try to get that information for you before the end of the net. Thank you. KK7ART.
SWP.
Yeah, that sounds like Jennifer. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Sun, for doing this. I just have a question. There was a small study done, and it was in California, and it was really about that asymptomatic that you measured. And they actually did a random sampling of 1,200 people, which I know statistically is very small. But they were pointing to evidence and looking for antibodies. This was part of the antibody testing. That maybe as high as 40% of these people, and they were all people who had not believed they had COVID, were actually showing positive to the antibodies. Does that sound like something that they're going to be doing more research on? And I guess it's really around that asymptomatic piece. Thank you.
Yeah, the antibody tests are really tricky. because, again, there are five approved antibody tests of the FDA, and only two of those have what we consider the really good accuracy you need if you're trying to tell for sure who was infected or not. But there are, I don't know, 20, 30 listed antibody tests out there that are not approved that people can still buy commercially. And so it really, again, depends upon what the study is. Most of the studies we've seen that seem to be the most reliable are suggesting that in general populations, we may be looking at 5% of the population has been infected, and a large number of those have been asymptomatic. In places like New York City actually, I think, is the one that reported this incredibly high rate of almost 50% infected. But they haven't said what test it is, and I've tried to actually look for that information, so I can't tell you what test it is. It also was not a true sampling. It was a sampling of people that were going in and out of grocery stores and big box stores in New York City. And so far in the United States, that's the highest rate that I've seen. I know Governor Cuomo is thinking that maybe that's really accurate. I would believe that New York City has a higher rate of people having been infected than anywhere else because they're so jammed close. Plus, they had infection earlier than most areas of the country, and they put their social distancing in relatively late. So when you consider all those things, plus the high amount of asymptomatic infections, I wouldn't be surprised that New York City has, 25%, 30%. I don't know if I can believe 50% of the people infected yet. And again, if they don't tell me which test, it's hard to believe the results. And let me explain that a little bit more. So with an antibody test, a lot of the three of the approved tests have what is going to be considered a 3% false positive. So if you took 100 people and you tested them, you would find out that three of those people said they were positive even when they had not had the virus. Now, if we think that, again, that half, that 3% really did have the virus, you'd probably have 6 out of 100 tested that said they were positive, and half of those would have had the virus, and half of them wouldn't have had the virus, and that makes the number really, really confusing. It particularly makes it difficult for any individual to say, oh, yeah, I have the virus because I had a positive antibody test, because if you were one of those six people, your odds are actually 50-50 whether you were a false test or whether you were really infected. So the antibody tests aren't really great unless they are almost zero false positives. And so far, there's only two tests that seem to be approaching that mark.
W0EDF with a question.
Okay, go ahead, Richard, with your question, and I'll repeat it if you're the one that's doing the recording so we can hear it.
Yeah, I heard a story that said that they weren't 100% sure that if you got the disease that you would have immunity. In other words, you could likely get it again. And they also said that depending upon the severity that you got COVID-19 might determine how immune you were to a second infection. What do you know about that?
Okay, so just to paraphrase that, in talking about the having had COVID, whether or not there is an immunity from COVID, and it may be relate, and does it relate to the viral load? So with that in mind, here's Dr. Sun.
Yeah, unfortunately, right now, we know nothing about whether you're going to be immune after you get COVID, and if so, for how long that will last. All we can do is base it upon other viruses. We know that with the coronaviruses that cause some of the common colds that are floating around all the time, most people, when they get one of those, they won't get that virus again. that year. But by next year, they could get the same virus again. So it's a very short-lived immunity. That's also fairly similar to influenza. If you get a one strain of flu one year, you're probably not going to get it again that year, but you could get it again next year. Chances are, if you got it again next year, you wouldn't maybe be quite as sick. You have a little bit of protection, but you don't have a major, you don't have protection to keep you from getting ill with flu for more than about a year. And again, with flu, there's so many strains of it, you're only protected against the individual strain that you happen to be sick with. And in any given year, there's usually two or three that are circulating, and it might not be the same two or three next year. So that's the problem with immunity with flu. However, if we look to, like, SARS, when SARS came out, and SARS is the closest model we have for COVID-19, people with SARS seem to be immune for strong immunity for somewhere between 3 to 5 years, and then their immunity gradually declined. So that's kind of the best-case scenario that we're hoping for with COVID-19, but we have zero data on that so far. And just because you had antibodies, even if it was 100% true positive, just because you have antibodies doesn't mean that you would be immune. It just means that your body made antibodies. They may not be enough to keep you from getting sick again.
KA7SOX with question.
Okay, John G., go ahead with your question, please.
Yeah, I was wondering if the antibody testing is available in Oregon, specifically in Salem.
You could probably find it unofficially. The state and the hospitals are not doing any official testing yet. And I have not heard of any, well, take that back. I may have heard of Providence playing with doing some antibody testing in a population up there, but I don't remember the actual results of it, nor has it become well publicized with which test it is again. So I think the best studies that we've seen so far is there's been two in California and one in New York that probably are going to say that in California, 3 to 5% of the people have been infected. In New York, it's a lot more.
So KG7GDB here for ID. So again, when we do these kinds of medical research things, they take time to get the results. And you know, I don't know if you're aware how long it takes to get an immunity, but you know, this is, there are some types of immune things, like if you've had the Shigella, you know, shingles test vaccine, you need to get that like a series of three of those, and they're a month or two apart. And that's because it takes a while to build up an immunity, and then you hit them again, and that's that repeated kind of dosing sort of thing of whether a person's really immune or not. That obviously takes months to figure out. So anyway, let's sort of comment on the studies that are in progress here.
And the antibody test, again, it really depends upon what the test is. The five approved ones, there's one from Mount Sinai in New York that's only being used in the Mount Sinai system. It's very good, okay? If that's what the New York data came from, I'd be enthusiastic, but nobody's said that I can find in writing. There is another one that's a blood draw that you have to send off to a specialized lab. It's also very good. It's probably pretty expensive, and it requires a blood draw. The other three approved tests are what they call rapid tests that they can do by poking your finger in a doctor's office. And those are just simply whether a doctor's office has decided to purchase one of those or not. And if your doctor or your health system has one, you can probably get the test. But none of those have the accuracy that we want to see.
W0EDF.
Yes, Richard, go ahead.
Some states have decided that they're going to start opening and do less social distancing or stay-at-home orders, open businesses and so on. What is the danger in that? And I know some of the other states said that they were going to step back and kind of look at this as an experiment to see how well that works. What's your opinion on that?
Okay, so Richard, just for the recording here, is asking about the other states which are opening up early. What happens with that, and are other states actually kind of waiting to see if this as an experiment? So here's Dr. Sund.
I definitely think that these are all experiments, and from the scientist in me thinks this is very fascinating, and I am dying to see how they all go. I don't think most places are waiting to see how one does before they decide. It's just that some of them are jumping for it more, and some of them are going to be more cautious. In Oregon, we will be starting to do a few things. For example, probably by next week, we will be doing medical procedures again in Oregon. The target date from Governor Brown was to have that up and to have the guidance for that to be available by the 1st at the latest. And so that means people in healthcare can start doing the surgeries and the diagnostic procedures that they've been postponing. And that's really, really necessary because, as we all know, some people have not been getting things that could be really important, like to control cancer or things like that. They're going to do this carefully. They are going to make sure that the physical distance and waiting areas and procedure areas is maintained. They have to make sure that they've got plenty of PPE without dipping into the hospital stores that they would need. Then when they start, they're going to have to prioritize based upon how important the tests are. So somebody that's just waiting for a routine colonoscopy is going to wait a long time, whereas somebody who's been maybe having some blood in their stool is going to get a colonoscopy much sooner. And in all these cases, they're supposed to have balanced the risk to the patient of what will happen if they don't get the test versus the risk of increased risk of COVID by spending time in a healthcare setting. That said, I think that in general, our risks of getting sick in a healthcare setting in Oregon right now are pretty low. Our number of hospitalized patients statewide is pretty low, you know, in the neighborhood of 250 to 300 people in the hospital right now statewide. So with COVID, so that means your chances of if you have to go in and get a procedure done, you should go in and get it done. They've got the equipment now, but I still wouldn't go in and do, you know, my facelift. Some of the other social distancing things that you will probably start seeing is you might start seeing some retail that's available for pickup that wasn't open before. You might see more state parks and national parks and trails and things like that open. But in Oregon, the goal is to open just a little bit and then to watch and see what happens to our case numbers. And again, this is what I consider the R-naught experiments. How many people do get sick from each person that's currently infected? Right now, it's probably a little bit less than one based upon the amount of people that are out and doing things in Oregon right now. If we start having more people do things in Oregon, eventually that number will climb. But if it only climbs to 1 or 1.1 or 1.2, that's not too bad, and we can probably handle that as a community. But if we do social distancing too quick, and all of a sudden every infected person is infecting 2 or 2.5 people because they're around that many people, all of a sudden you're going to be right where you were back in March in another 1 to 2 months. And so some of us are looking at places like Georgia and wondering whether that's going to happen there. But only time will tell.
JLO.
And this is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo for ID here. We have the emergency preparedness set. Jeff, go ahead.
Dr. Sun, one thing I'm not clear on in all this is if you feel like you're getting symptoms, a little bit of fever and you know, feel like the flu's going on, how much time, what's the fuse, how much time do you have to get tested and contact your doctor, get tested, possibly be hospitalized before the condition really worsens to a point where you might have wished that you had contacted your doctor earlier? KA7JLO.
The way it looks like is that people tend to get their first mild symptoms usually around day 5. It can be much later up to day 11, but on average it's around day 5 after they were exposed. And those can be pretty mild. It feels just like you're getting, you know, coming down with something. Could feel like a cold, a touch of a flu. And that's not very exciting, and so you may or may not notice it. A lot of times then people get better and nothing else happens. But the other thing that happens is either they get better or they stay the same, and then usually around day 8 to 9, they get much worse. And that's often when the really bad fever kicks in and the muscle aches and the chills and all that kind of stuff. So when should you get tested? If you are healthy, person to start with, and you're under the age of 60, you will not get tested until you are short of breath and looking at needing to go into the hospital. I'd still tell your doctor about it soon, you know, sooner than that, so they can kind of follow you, but you probably won't get a test until then. If you are over 60 or you've got underlying health conditions, I would say you should get tested as soon as it feels more than just like a cold or a touch of something. You probably wouldn't need to go to the hospital then, and knowing isn't probably going to change whether you have to go to the hospital or not. But personally, I would feel more comfortable if I, you know, knew that I had it or didn't have it. But I'll also throw out that just because I tested negative doesn't mean I don't have it, because the tests, again, are not perfect. And depending upon which day it is, you know, you could have a, you know, 20% chance that the test didn't pick it up even though you were positive. So bottom line, over 60, underlying healthcare conditions, ask your doctor for a test when you feel that it's going to be a little bit more than a touch of cold or touch of a flu. And if all you have is a touch of a cold or a touch of flu, you know that the instant you start to feel bad at all, you completely quarantine yourself. And even if it goes away, you want to stay in that quarantine for at least no symptoms for 72 hours. If it gets worse and you test positive, then you're going to be quarantined for 14 days. But if you don't know what you have, the still recommendation is if you've had any kind of cold flu symptoms at all, even mild, that you should quarantine yourself until 72 hours without any symptoms whatsoever.
Oh, well, you?
Yes, Paul, go ahead with your question.
Could Dr. Sun comment on the use of the pulse oximeters for measuring the oxygen concentration in the blood? Over.
If you have one, yeah, you can check it if you're having symptoms. If your blood oxygen level gets below 90, you should be going in and getting checked. But if you don't have underlying lung disease and you don't already have a pulse oximeter, I don't know that you need to run out and get one. There have been a couple of doctors that have said, well, if we just identified it sooner, we would get them treatment sooner. That's not been generally accepted. It is true that you can get a very, very low oxygen level with not as many symptoms as we're used to, but it's still probably not worth buying it and monitoring it. We've not been able to show any change in outcome just because people are monitoring their blood oxygen level. I do recommend if you feel sick at all, though, that you know what your baseline respiratory kind of capacity is. Like, you know, how much can you walk around your house before you feel short of breath? I mean, if you can run a marathon, you don't need to do that test. But if you're kind of old and not in great shape, know what your basic, how much you have to do before you feel short of breath. And then you can do that every day. And if you notice that you're getting more short of breath with the same activity, that's the time you want to be talking to your doctor. And I think, you know, if you are challenging your body, then you're going to notice the low oxygen more than if you're just laying in a bed. And so knowing what your physical capability is and knowing when you can't do it because you feel winded or you can't get your air or you feel lightheaded, those things are all things that you can check really easily without having to spend any money on a pulse oximeter, which, by the way, are hard to get right now if you don't already have one.
Oh, will you? Are there problems with self-administering and getting a false reading?
Let me just clarify, Paul. You're saying that are there problems with the pulse oximeter self-monitoring yourself and getting a false reading? Is that that's the question?
There was that untrained people were using the pulse oximeter wrong and getting false numbers over.
Well, I suspect people can use anything wrong and get false numbers. If you buy a, you know, you could go online and, you know, do reviews of pulse oximeters. They're a common enough thing that people use for chronic lung disease that they are commonly available. If you buy them from a reputable producer, an oxygen sat, and then you follow the instructions and you've got, you don't have, like, big, thick nails or you don't have, like, really no circulation in your hands, most of those cases, your O2 sat's going to work fine. On the other hand, if you buy an O2 sat monitor now from some place you're not really sure where it's coming from because you can't get the mainstream ones, then I would worry about both of them being accurate and whether people, whether they work reliably, whether they start and stop. Again, there's a lot of kind of bogus medical products out there on the market right now because people are anxious for getting things. And so if you could not get a well-recommended, reputable oxygen saturation monitor right now and know how to use it, like practice it when you're feeling well, and so you know exactly what your normal oxygen sat would be, that's a that you could do. But if you're not going to be able to do that, you'd be better off not testing it at all.
Oh, well, you, thank you.
Foxtrot Charlie Hotel with a question.
Okay, Foxtrot Charlie Hotel. That's Charlie. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, good evening, you guys. I got a question. I've been off work for a little, couple days more than a month now. This got crazy. I talked to my doctor. Doctor said, yeah, you got a front-facing public tongue and a job. You should stay home. I have emphysema, and I'm on lung medicine. I'm on heart medicine. I'm mid-50s. My boss is now, it's been a month, and because things are starting to open up, things are loosening up, my boss is texting me, just tell your doctor you want to go back to work. I'm willing to do that if it's safe. My question is this one of those things I should really still stay on guard for, or really, I can go back to work? I'm sorry, Kilo Bravo 7, Foxtrot Charlie Hotel.
I am not in. Statistically, right now, if you went back to work, your odds are pretty good because we don't have that many cases in Oregon, although I would point out that Marion County has almost twice as high rate per population as anywhere else in the state, including Portland. So we're worse in Marion County than elsewhere, but the numbers are still low. So your statistical chance of getting sick as an individual is low, but I also know as we increase what people are able to do, that those numbers are going to start climbing a little bit. And so it definitely is going to increase some risk. the safest thing is for people with underlying health conditions or people that are older is to remain completely socially distanced. So can you do your job at your desk without having anybody within 6 feet of you? Can you wear a mask? Can you ask people that come in to have to wear a mask? Can you have your windows open so you have a lot of air circulation? How many people have to be around you? If you have to have a bunch of people around you, your risks are going to go up. So these are all the tricky individual decisions that we're going to have to make. And I personally don't think we should be asked to go back to work if we've got health conditions or an older age unless we can meet social distancing guidelines. And that's what Governor Brown is trying to say is going to be the requirement. So that would be what I'd ask your boss, is so how are we going to meet the social distancing guidelines laid out by Governor Brown? And if you can meet those, then we can talk about me coming back.
All right, well, thank you very much. You mentioned masks. I didn't intend on asking two questions, but, yeah, I didn't realize this was that airborne. Is there a real need for a mask, or is that just based on precaution?
The masks that we currently have, the ones that are homemade, they're so-so. I don't feel super strongly about them. There's not a great science behind them. However, maybe if you are sick or if somebody that walks into your space is sick, they will decrease the chance that they're going to distribute droplets on the surfaces around you. How much? I don't know, 50% decrease, 60% decrease? Is that going to mean you're fully protected? Absolutely not. You need a surgical mask for that. But is it better than nothing? Yeah, maybe. So if you're going to have to come within 6 feet of people or you're going to have a lot of people in and out of your space, yeah, you know, if you had everybody wear a mask when they came in, you know, it might decrease your chances of getting sick by 50%. Maybe better than nothing. But it's not by any means a wonder cure. And it's just going to keep people that are sick from putting virus into your environment. You could still breathe it in no matter what.
All right, well, thank you very much. You've answered some good questions for me, gave me something to think about. You have a great evening. Charlie, Kilo Bravo 7, Foxtrot Charlie Hotel. We're clear.
Okay, KG7, GDB. Well, so far there is there's an Oregon employer guidance form that you can get from OHA, and until the guidelines are changed, until she, that's what we're talking about right now, she doesn't say that all businesses are closed. She says there's certain businesses that have to be closed, and there's certain businesses that are allowed to stay open, but they have to meet these guidelines for social distancing and protecting the employees. So if your job is to shake people's hands, I don't think that's going to work very well, okay? You're going to figure something else out there. So it really depends on, they really wanted to have somebody who would be a safety officer in charge and then to monitor people, make sure that they had a good policy as far as people coming into work and not being sick. Of course, that's even more risky now because some people will be asymptomatic. But, you wouldn't want to meet in closed working cubicles next to people or have meetings in boardrooms, small rooms, things like that. If you can do your job without doing that, then that's safer. KG7, GB, any other questions for Dr. Sun about COVID-19?
Kilo India 7, Sierra Oscar X-ray.
Okay, Jay, go ahead.
Well, one of the businesses that are being hurt the most, obviously, are restaurants. And I was wondering if the doctor could give us recommendations or give them recommendations of what they could do to maintain the social distancing and make it safe for people to actually go eat, dining in, not just the delivery, but dining in a restaurant.
I wish I knew that one. I'm a real foodie. I miss going out to good restaurants. The safest thing a restaurant could do is have an outdoor space with the table 6 feet apart. If any restaurant out there that has an outdoor space that the table is just 6 feet apart, meaning from one chair to the next closest chair, there's a good 6 foot gap, I'm going to them. I'll be there the next day. However, restaurants inside, theoretically, a restaurant could make sure that their tables were all at least 6 foot apart, that their servers wore a mask so that they would decrease the chance of spewing virus if they were an asymptomatic carrier. They could give you paper menus that they could be thrown out after each use so you didn't have to retouch surfaces. I would wash my hands immediately before I ate, and then I would wash my hands again after I left. And as long as our numbers remain low, I would feel a little safe. But in general, I don't think restaurants are a very safe setting in general. And that, or bars, or any places where you have people staying in the same closed and shared airspace for a prolonged period of time. And that's because when you look at all the data we're picking up on COVID, there really seems to be a significant problem with aerosolized virus floating around in shared airspaces for a while. Exactly how much, we don't know, but if you look at all the places where there are outbreaks, they're not explained by people touching things. They are only explained by people sharing airspace. And if you have somebody sitting there for an hour or two eating a meal that is an asymptomatic carrier, they are going to be breathing COVID into the air. And it's just going to float around the room a little bit. And depending upon where the air conditioning is and things like that, it might blow to the next table. There was actually a little study that looked at that in a Chinese restaurant, and they could show that all the tables in one line, three tables in a row, got people sick. The tables in the row next to them did not, based upon the air pattern. And so I just don't feel comfortable being in a closed airspace with multiple other people for a prolonged period of time. And personally, that means I'm not going inside a restaurant for a long time.
Okay, KI7SRX again. It seems to me that one of the most highly recommended things to do to avoid the infection is washing your hands, which implies that you get the virus from touching things, you know, touching objects that have the virus on it. Then there's also the contagion from airborne. Has anybody done any study on what percentage of the cases are from airborne infection versus the surface infection?
No actual research on it, just people commenting upon patterns of infection. We went into this thinking it was mostly going to be just like flu and cold viruses, and those are basically all surfaces. If we all washed our hands as much as we've been doing with COVID, we wouldn't have flu seasons hardly at all. We would not have very many colds, because those viruses definitely seem to be primarily droplet-driven. However, COVID, when you look at the combination of data out there, the fact that we can find the particles floating in the air 3 hours after they've done an aerosolization in a lab, so we know it floats around for up to 3 hours. We know that we have found COVID in the ventilation shafts of patient rooms and on surfaces that they could only have gotten there by floating. And we know that the places where the biggest outbreaks have been are ones with intensely shared airspaces. Probably the best example of that was a choir up in Skagit, about an hour north of Seattle. And they had a choir rehearsal in mid-March. They knew about COVID at that point in time. They debated about canceling it. But they believed that as long as they didn't touch each other, and they were really cautious about droplets, that they would be safe. And so there were 60 people that came from all over the Seattle area, a couple hours in all directions. They did not hug. They all washed their hands when they came in. They used hand sanitation. They were incredibly, incredibly careful. The 60 of them sat there in the room, didn't touch any shared services, but they sang together for an hour and a half. 45 out of the 60 got sick. If that's not airborne, nothing is. And yeah, so they were singing. That's probably putting more virus out there than if you were just talking, and that's probably putting more virus out there than if you were just sitting. But it does tell us that there is airborne transmission, at least if you're in the room, same room as somebody that's got it. What percentage of that? I don't know. We don't know that. We just know that by looking at where the clusters are happening, the worst clusters seem to be people sharing airspace for prolonged periods of time, particularly in relatively closed spaces.
So that would imply that the hand washing is sort of almost secondary then, right?
I think it's probably going to be 50-50. I think a lot of the sporadic cases that people are getting, which is, you know, and depending upon what state you're in, anywhere from two-thirds to half the cases are sporadic community contact, and I think a lot of those are going to be from hand-washing and droplets. We know it happens that way. But we also, what was denied, actively denied by the World Health Organization, by the CDC, by a lot of people, it was actively denied for a long time that there could be any aerosol transmission. And yet, all the data is pretty overwhelming that it exists as well. We just don't know what percentage. I think you got to do both. You've got to be paying attention to both. I still disinfect. I still hand wash. I still have my hot zone. I do all of those things. And I will also not share airspace, and I will stay 6 feet away from people, and I've got to do both. That's the only way I would feel comfortable not getting sick.
Well, to me, that sounds like great advice. That's my last question, KI7SOX.
Okay, so actually, we are at 1 minute after the hour. If anybody has a final burning question to ask us, do it now. Otherwise, I will close the net down.
KG7, TDI.
Kilo Golf 7, Oscar Whiskey November. This is Jerry in Dallas.
Okay, see, I got Kilo Golf 7, Tango Delta India, Dan, is that right? And then Oscar Whiskey November. So, is that, am I correct on Dan's call there?
Correct, KG7 TDI, this is Dan. My question would be is, I guess this would reinforce the fact that by wearing a mask, if you were infected, it's more to protect everyone else around you than it is for you if you don't have it and somebody is near you that does, just simply because they could be breathing it and you could just walk through and get it on you. Does that make sense?
Definitely the mask is to keep, it's not going to protect you, it's going to keep other people from putting virus into the environment. Personally, I think the masks are going to be best at preventing droplets. So people that are wearing masks in a grocery store are probably less likely to put droplets on the handles of the grocery cart and on the doorknobs of things that they touch. I am not very convinced that homemade face masks are going to block the tiny aerosolized things that can cause us to get sick from breathing in air. They just have to be much tighter in order to do that. And based upon what we know in the past from things like measles and tuberculosis, which are also small aerosolized things, I am personally not convinced that a handmade, homemade fabric face mask is going to keep the little aerosolized droplets from getting out, but it will probably cut down on the droplets that you could get sick from touching things.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have KG7OWN, Jerry. I think you get the last question this evening. Go ahead.
It isn't a question. I want to give a great big thank you to your sweetheart for the job she did and how good it was. I thank you for all you do. Thank you.
Okay, well, you're welcome, and she's smiling and says thank you back there. Very good. I'm glad you are finding some use in this, and we are, again, recording this. I think Richard's making recordings, and we're making these available on the WA7ABU groups.io page. You can get there again. If you're not already a member of WA7ABU group, you go to the main website, wa7abu.com, and click on the upper left corner, and that will take you to that group, and you can join it. It's free, and in the file section there, we have archives of the different sessions that we've had. You had all have a lot of very good questions and information to, over the last month that we've been doing this, so it's still a valuable resource for people. So, very good. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the net. Time is now 8:05 p.m. This concludes the 529 Emergency Preparedness Net. This net meets each Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on 145.29 MHz, and our thanks go out to Dan, WA7ABU, for the use of the repeater. Thanks to all who participated today and to those who stood by to give us a clear channel. Thanks again to our guest, Dr. Sheila Sund. Again, we're just going to do these on Tuesday unless something very exciting happens in the meantime. Hopefully we can do this again next Tuesday. But at any rate, I'll probably be here again next Tuesday at 7 p.m. So look for us then. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. Again, I'm closing the net at 8:05 p.m. And now we return the repeater to normal undirected temperature operations. Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, I am clear.
Thank you, Brett and Sheila. And next month, we will have the entire CTR Amateur Radio Club hopefully checking in.